Coffee houses make all sorts of people sociable. The rich and the poor meet together, as also do the learned and unlearned. It improves arts, merchandise, and all other knowledge. For here, an inquisitive man that aims at good learning may get more in an evening than he shall by books in a month. I have heard a worthy friend of mine, who was of good learning, say that he did think that coffee houses had improved his useful knowledge as much as the universities have. From a collection for the Improvement of Husbandry and Trade, Volume 3, by John Houghton, published in 1728.
In Viking times, a thing was a gathering, a place where leaders and warriors could meet and talk.
In the 21st century, our thing is a virtual place where history academics and enthusiasts from around the world can come together to share knowledge. We're your hosts, Miranda Schmiederer
and Lucas Norton. So hold on to your helmets for this episode of that Jorvik Viking Thing podcast. So you might be wondering why Miranda just read out a quote about an 18th century coffee house. The reason for that is we are opening our own coffee house.
Yay! It's actually opening tomorrow on the 23rd of July. It's going to be at Barley Hall. It's open every day from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. serving a selection of coffees and snacks.
And Barley Hall and the coffee shop are located in Coffee Yard, a very, very appropriate name for our new coffee shop. And this area may have actually possibly been the location of York's first ever coffee shop. There's actually a quote from a book dating to 1736, published by Francis Drake.
Really?
Not that Francis Drake, oh, a different one.
Okay.
And he says, "From Patrick Pool or Swinegate, before mentioned, at the West End goes a thoroughfare from Stonegate called Coffee Yard. This name can be of no very old date, that Bury having not been yet a century known in England. I suppose that the first coffee house in York stood here." So that's from E. Barackham, or The History of Antiquities of the City of York. And it goes on and on. A very long Georgian name, as they all are. It's like an encyclopedia of York. So he's suggesting that that courtyard where Barley Hall is the home to York's first ever coffee house. Maybe.
And so now we're bringing it back, aren't we? I mean, so the building that we're putting it in, what's the significance of that building there?
So that particular building, we're not 100% certain whether that's where this possible coffee house may have been, but we think it may have been the site of a Georgian print works as well. A printing press would have been in operation there. We've got records of numerous printers operating within Coffee Yard, including a famous guy named Thomas Gents as well, who may have printed newspapers and books from that location.
It's been completely renovated. It's absolutely beautiful. The building is actually just as old as Barley Hall is. It's got a bunch of beautiful medieval timbers that you can see from the actual coffee shop. It's going to have archaeological finds on display and all sorts of interpretation videos as well. There's actually even going to be stuff coming in the future. So if you drop by in the next few months, it might be totally different from when you come back and visit us again in a year's time. So this felt like a really good time to talk about drinks, right? Like it's a good follow-up to our Drink Like a Viking episode. Basically, all of the drinks covered in that episode, water, dairy, wine, beer, mead, they can all pretty much be applied to any time period in British history from prehistory to the 17th century. A Celt, Roman, Saxon, Viking, and Norman would have all felt very at home in a Tudor tavern with very recognizable drinks served there. But in the 17th century, it seems to change a little bit, doesn't it?
I'm now picturing you in a Billin's Head time machine picking up all of these people throughout history to come to your tavern.
What a really fun party, right?
So yeah, the 17th century is where everything changes. Stuff gets weird. New things appear that people could not have possibly imagined before. Now, there are new types of alcohol in this period. We're not going to cover those today. I think they deserve an episode in their own right at some point in the future. But there are three very strange, unusual, exotic drinks which appear all within a few decades of each other. These are coffee, tea, and chocolates.
I think those are three of my favorite things. Shall we just go through drink by drink then? Let's start with coffee, the top of your list. Tell us more about coffee, Lucas.
Okay, so can you guess where coffee originally comes from?
I mean, when I'm like at the store, often when I'm looking at like the coffee, it all seems to come from South America.
Yeah, I always thought coffee must originate from somewhere in Latin America. I'm completely wrong.
Really? Okay.
It's actually from Africa originally.
I'm surprised by that because we had connections to Africa for a very long time. So you would have thought that something like coffee, if it came from Africa, would have made its way up here a little bit sooner.
Yeah. I guess the climates, you need to have a nice warm, hot place to grow it. And England is, it's quite warm and hot.
On Tuesday, you can grow your coffee, not any other time of the year.
So it's indigenous to the highlands of Ethiopia. And there's actually a lovely legend about the origins of coffee. There's a goat herder named Kaldi, I believe. He was out walking with his goats and he observed the energizing effects that this mysterious bean had when his goats nibbled upon it. They got quite frisky, apparently, started hopping around all over the place. So then he tasted the coffee plant as well, and he found it filled him with energy. He danced around, poetry and song just flowed forth from him. He was basically incredibly energized and full of caffeine after gobbling up this plant. And the plants then made its way to the Arabian Peninsula. Yemen was a place where much of it was grown. And they've got their own folklore that apparently the angel Gabriel brought coffee down and gave it to the Prophet Muhammad, who was suffering from narcolepsy. And that cured it. So coffee is a gift from heaven, according to some people.
So when did coffee make its way to the UK?
So it's in the 17th century, it finally makes its arrival here in this country, and people were really weirded out by it. Because you can imagine, people have spent their entire lives, they've spent centuries and centuries drinking beer, largely, a bit of wine if you can afford it, some funny smelling water now and then. And this drink is hot to start with, that's a bit weird. It's like a soup, but it's a drink. It's so bitter and pungent as well. I think everyone who tries coffee for the first time goes, ugh! Then after your second or third one, you're like, oh, it grows on you actually after a while. And of course, people notice the strange effects it has upon the body, the way it wakes you up. It's almost the opposite of alcohol, isn't it? Alcohol makes you a bit sleepy and lazy. This must have seemed like a bizarre kind of medicine rather than a sort of drink you'd have with your breakfast or something like that. And people just didn't really know what to make of it originally. Some people thought it must be so bad for you. It tastes foul. It tastes like old leather and smelly shoes or something. And it seemed a bit unnatural. Whereas others thought, actually, I quite like this. I can stay up late into the night doing all sorts of work now. And along with the other drinks, tea and chocolate, it became a symbol of sobriety as well. You could meet with a friend and have a drink and not get drunk. How amazing is that?
That is groundbreaking, isn't it?
There were some very strange medical things linked to it as well. I've seen all sorts of pamphlets from the late 17th and early 18th century, which claim very strange things, like it cures any disease you can think of, basically.
That's very useful. I wonder if our doctors today know about that.
Apparently it makes your teeth white, which my dentist tells otherwise. There are also some other kind of anti-coffee pamphlets as well, which say it causes every disease you can possibly imagine. There's an interesting petition from the 1670s, which claims to be from the housewives of England, because coffee is making their men impotent, supposedly. So there's all sorts of strange stuff out there. It's a little bit like trying to get news from social media. It's the 17th, 18th century equivalent, looking through these pamphlets.
I really love the idea that these wives were like, oh no, this drink is making our men impotent. Let them drink alcohol like they always have. That'll fix it. All right, so despite some people protesting, I mean, it seemed like coffee was pretty much here to stay, though. So can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, coffee and its use once it was here?
Yeah, so undoubtedly some people were drinking it for perceived health benefits, to cure scurvy or gout or something like that. Though, would it cause gout, actually? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, it certainly doesn't have any, what is it, vitamin C?
Something like that for scurvy.
I don't know that it would necessarily make any of those things better.
But overall, coffee, it was revered as this elixir of energy. and a kind of catalyst of change. And it tends to sort of become viewed as a symbol of the Enlightenment, really. If you think about the preceding time period, people drink alcohol just all day, every day, it seems. And we tend to have a pretty negative view of the Middle Ages, unfortunately. But then the 18th century is this age of philosophy, of enlightenment, of science. And some people like to theorise that coffee is the reason for this. It wakes the brain up. People discuss and debate politics, philosophy, science. The age of reason comes into being thanks to coffee.
Around a similar time then was the introduction of tea. I mean, that is very kind of, if you think of, especially for me, when I thought of England before I moved over here, tea is kind of synonymous with England, although it's, you know, a relatively modern introduction, isn't it? Tell us more about tea then.
Yeah, interestingly, tea becomes popular after coffee in England. The English were renowned as the preeminent coffee drinkers in the world. And tea was just there in the shadows, a kind of a hipster drink, really, that gradually grew in popularity, and it overtakes coffee as the main drink of the British around the mid-18th century. So where does tea come from? Any guesses?
I mean, I associate tea with, like, India.
It's from China, this type of tea. There is a version of tea, I believe, that's native to India. The, kind of the Assam sorts of ones, I think they're probably native. There are different varieties of it, but it's the Chinese kind of green teas that are coming over first.
I do love a green tea. Thank you, China.
So tea has, again, strange, legendary, mythological origins. There's an 8th century Chinese text called The Classic of Tea, which sounds very British, doesn't it, rather than Chinese, which explores how to brew a proper cup. And it says that according to Chinese myth, the Emperor Shen Nung, known as the Divine Husbandman, discovered tea in the 3rd millennium BCE, so a very, very long time ago. He supposedly encountered a burning bush of leaves, and the aroma of this burning bush was quite nice. He marvelled at it. So plucked some of these leaves off, put them in hot water, and thought, yummy, we should be drinking this every day. And he then introduced the cultivation of it, and it spread across all of China. There's also a slightly strange story, which I believe comes from both Indian and Japanese Buddhist folklore, where a Buddhist priest was trying to battle sleep, his enemy. So he removed his own eyelids, as you do, threw the eyelids onto soil, and they magically turned into the tea plant. So from that day onwards, if you want to conquer sleep, you don't need to chop your eyelids off. You have a nice cup of tea instead. So interesting stories there. So much like coffee, tea starts coming to Britain in the 17th century, and it was very, very, very expensive. These things are coming through middlemen, mostly. There aren't British ships going to China to pick this up like they would in later periods. So you're buying more of Dutch merchants, for instance. So tea is very much exclusive to the upper ranks of society at this first point. But then tea trade grows with China. And more middle class, the middling sort of society starts to have tea as well. It's viewed as healthy and wondrously sober. It's a civilized and civilizing drink. It's a bit strange the way they drink it, though, at this point. They don't tend to put milk in it like we would do today. They love putting sugar into it, but also egg yolks as well go into it.
I'm sure there was something on the Drink Like a Viking episode we talked that they put egg yolks into there as well. They need to stop. They need to calm down putting eggs in beverages.
And tea was adopted very enthusiastically by women during the 17th and 18th century. I think coffee was viewed as a bit of a bitter, robust and masculine drink, something you might shout about or something, whereas tea is delicate and genteel. You can have it in your salon, in your parlour, and discuss literature with the other ladies of society. And gradually men start to take it up as well in the mid-18th century, possibly due to the cost of coffee compared to tea, as tea became cheaper, and it became the main drink that British people like to drink. We forgot about coffee for a very long time, I think, after that.
All right, then. So what about our final beverage, if you can really call it that? I mean, chocolate is not normally a beverage. I guess you can have hot chocolate, though, can't you? Is that the kind of thing they were drinking at the time?
Traditionally, that was the only way you'd have chocolate. Yeah, you wouldn't have bars of chocolate until much, much, much later. So chocolate, where does that come from? Any guesses?
I know this one. This one comes from the Americas.
It does, yes. So chocolate was consumed by Native Americans for many thousands of years before Europeans arrived. The Aztecs believed it was a gift from the god Quetzalcoatl. It's got divine origins. When the Spanish arrived in Mexico, they said that Montezuma basically drank nothing but chocolates. The way they drank it, though, was quite different to what the style in which we would drink it now. They put all sorts of herbs into it that apparently turned it red, which is interesting. And also lots and lots of spicy things as well. They tended to drink it cold, apparently, as well. Which doesn't sound too nice.
No.
Like, cold coffee and tea is quite horrible, isn't
yeah.
it?
Maybe it's like, you know, chocolate milk or something,
yeah.
maybe.
Or a frappuccino or something, yeah. So the Aztecs loved this stuff, as did other Native American peoples. Europeans tried it and went, why is it so bitter? Why is it so spicy? And in England, we traditionally don't have flavoursome foods like that. We have much more plainer flavours, usually. So the English found it too bitter and spicy, so to acclimatise it to their palate, they added some things like cinnamon and nutmeg and vanilla, and of course lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sugar as well.
Yeah.
Sugar is the other big substance in this period. They domesticate it basically to suit the local tastes. It's quite complicated, though, in its preparation. I mean, tea, you basically go and buy some leaves. You put the leaves in a pot.
Yeah.
And you heat some water. Coffee, you've got to grind it and roast it. During the 18th century, commercial roasters start to appear, so you can buy your coffee ready to be brewed. But chocolate, it's got to kind of be made into a cake, which sounds a bit strange. But by a cake, we mean like a lump, not a delicious kind of sweet thing you're going to gobble up. So the British start importing chocolate once they capture Jamaica, because the Spanish had planted chocolate there. And quite often in Jamaica itself, they're going to mix it into other ingredients to form these big cakes. They pour it into moulds and then send those big solid masses, these sweetened, spiced masses to England. And you can buy these, break a chunk off, grate it, powder it, and mix it with the desired liquid and heat it up. Now, what liquid do you think you would mix in with cocoa?
I mean, if you want like nice cocoa,
yeah.
it would be like milk,
yeah.
right? But I mean, if you're like getting the cheaper stuff, hot water.
Yeah. So milk and water were options, definitely, in the 17th and 18th centuries, but they're not the most popular choices. They are not luxurious or decadent enough.
I mean, what else would pair well enough with chocolate?
Well, we probably wouldn't choose these today. I think palates have changed over the centuries, and this runs very counter to what I was just saying about these drinks being sober and civilizing.
Oh, no.
Brandy, port or sherry were considered quite acceptable to mix with cocoa. So chocolate was by far the most luxurious of all these drinks. There were dedicated chocolate houses in places like London where you could go and drink these strange port, cocoa, cinnamon, sugar mixes and go, I'm so rich, aren't I? So yummy. And apparently it was often a breakfast drink as well, so I don't know if the alcohol was included.
Yeah,
in
getting your day off to like
form.
Yeah, the right start there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh my god. So, I mean, now that we know what they're drinking, we need to know where they're drinking. Obviously, we said we're opening a coffee house, right? But tell us about coffee houses. Are they exactly like our kind of little modern day cafes?
They're a bit different to Starbucks, I have to say. Yes. Some are very, very, very different to the modern ones that we have. So the first coffee house that we're aware of opened in Oxford in the year 1652, so middle of the 17th century, and they became very popular very quickly, spread into London, of course, soon after that. London, hundreds of them spring up in a very short period of time, and they eventually reach York as well as early as the 1660s.
Okay, so almost straight away, really.
Yeah. Now, we're not sure exactly where or when the first coffee house opened in York. We think it could have been in Coffee Yard. That explains the obvious name. But there are records in, for example, parish records and court records of people whose profession are coffee men. So there's, for example, a guy named Charles Farnell, the coffee man. Henry Armistead, the coffee man of Stonegate, and William Womwell's house for the sale of ale and coffee in 1667. So there seems to be multiple coffee houses here in York in the 1660s. So before these places opened, if you wanted to socialise, you'd have to go to the pub, basically, the tavern or the ale house, and people go there to get drunk, don't they?
Yeah.
And even if you're not trying to get drunk, it's not the kind of place you'd probably go to discuss philosophy or physics or something like that, is
not
it?
Not exactly, no.
These coffee houses are very, very different to traditional ale houses. To start with, they are often full of newspapers because printing has really kicked off at this point. So you could go in there, pay a penny to get your drink, and learn about all the national and local news.
I mean, that makes sense with what you were saying about Thomas Gent being a printer. So there was printing in Coffee Yard, there was a coffee house in Coffee Yard. I'm seeing the connections here already.
Yeah. Some even began printing their own newspapers as well to cut down on costs rather than paying the local printers up the road.
I'm sure they were very reputable sources.
But overall, these were quite new and exciting places for men to socialise within. You could debate and deliberate on politics, philosophy and the sciences. They were venues for networking and doing business as well. All sorts of sober things pumped up on caffeine you could get up to here. A place for thinking and a place for talking. A sober and alert place to engage in very, very serious conversation. And coffee houses became known as penny universities by the late 17th century. They're compared to, you know, Oxford and Cambridge University, which are, of course, only for rich people to go and study in. But just paying a single penny, the price of admission and a cup of coffee, you could sit down and listen to other men debate the nature of gravity or something like that. They could talk about liberal politics, talk about trade with the East Indies, things like that. And people were a bit concerned about coffee houses initially. Charles II tried to ban them at one point. Because if you think about it, all these people are gathering together. They're not getting drunk. They're thinking.
Oh, no.
And they're talking.
Heavens.
Could this be the start of revolution? Of democracy?
Gasp.
So he tried to ban them. And
I'm sure it worked perfectly there. And we never heard of coffee ever again, did we?
Well, literally everybody ignored it. And I think very soon afterwards he said, I, King Charles, have repealed that law as your glorious patron of the coffee houses. All praise me, chosen by God to rule and whatnot. So coffee houses became really firmly embedded in British culture. Hundreds and hundreds popped up all over London. And by the late 18th century, there were probably about 60 trading here in York. And that's quite a lot considering that York is not that big compared to George and London, of course.
I mean, that 60, that's probably more than, you know, the number of individual, like, just coffee houses and stuff. There's only about 3 Starbucks. So.
Yeah. And we know a bit about some of these coffee houses that traded here in York. We know a few of their names. They tend to be named after the people who ran them. We've got Parker's Coffee House in Minster Yard, just around the corner from here. Harrison's Coffee House on Petergate. Charles and Woodhouse's in Minstergate. Mr. Harrison's on Oozegate. Mr. Gibson's on Lendal. Not very catchy names, I have to say. And we know that from things like newspaper articles, for example, at Parker's Coffee House, a mathematical doctor would occasionally come along to demonstrate sundials and entertain visitors with mysterious astrological notions. There were scientific lectures held at Harrison's Coffee House on Petergate in 1742, discussing things like the nature and properties of air. So very highbrow stuff going on in these places. When I go for a cup of coffee with friends, we're not discussing anything like that.
No.
We're going, did you watch last night's episode of Westworld or something?
I'm just trying to wake up usually at that point. I don't want to have a whole talk about philosophy.
So they really firmly embedded themselves in George and York's kind of academic, but also entertainment and leisure scene as well.
So, I mean, you're kind of making these places sound like utopias, right? So were they...
Well.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound like there was really any downside. It sounds like they really helped the economy, helped educate people. I'm sure they were absolutely perfect, right?
Well, there are coffee houses and there are coffee houses. So to start with, if you were to enter one of these places, the first thing that would hit you is the stink of tobacco.
Right.
So along with these exotic drinks coming from other parts of the world, tobacco is another huge foreign crop being imported to Britain at this point. And it seems that everybody smoked at this point in history. Even quite young children were smoking. I've read an account of a man going into a Georgian coffee house in London, and he observes a three-year-old boy lighting up his smoking pipe, which seems absolutely bizarre to us now. But people just thought it was really good for you. Schoolboys were beaten for not smoking, as if they're not eating their vegetables.
Oh, no. I guess it's kind of there was a thought, wasn't there, that if it felt good, it was good for you sort of thing.
Yeah. A bit like coffee, people thought tobacco just cured everything. I found multiple mentions of people who claimed that tobacco prevents plague.
Right.
There were, of course, devastating plague outbreaks in London in the 1660s. And all these books are saying, I hear on good authority that people who smoked did not die of plague during that period.
They just died of cancer instead.
Basically, yeah. So everybody was smoking. If you went into one of these places, there's not much oxygen.
No.
So that's one of the downsides, I'd have to say. The stench of tobacco. Another downside that we have to mention, of course, is there's a reason why these things are so cheap. A lot of this is produced by slaves. Sugar, chocolate, and coffee, these were all grown in the Caribbean at this point. So there's a reason why people are able to enjoy this at such low prices in this country.
You can't forget that there would have been millions of people who were suffering, and that was their entire life just for the production of these, you know, new drinks.
Yeah, it was quite a long time. It was in the 19th century when the slave trade ended. And also, coffee houses, while some were these penny universities, where you could learn about the nature and properties of air, discuss the latest shipping forecasts and things like that, others were dens of sin.
I was wondering if we were going to get to that. I mean, there is the kind of, you know, anywhere that I guess a bunch of men would have gotten together, there would have been a certain kind of person hanging around, is in my mind, right? Were there prostitutes hanging out at these places?
Some of them definitely, yeah. Yes. A lot of these, whilst the big sign outside would say coffee house, they're basically a pub that has a coffee pot in the corner. People are going there to just get absolutely hammered and going, oh yeah, let's go out for a cup of coffee. Hiccup. People are gambling in these places as well, getting into debt over that too, drinking huge amounts of alcohol, and meeting certain ladies of the evening.
Well, I think that this is, you know, there's a bit of a connection there for us at Barley Hall as well, isn't there? If there was a coffee house in Coffee Yard, that is right off of a very famous street in York, isn't it? Known
yes.
as Grape Lane.
Yes.
But once upon a time known as something much, much dirtier than that.
Yes, it was a Grope something lane. There was a bit of a renaming of some of these dirty streets in the 19th century. But if you look on old maps of York, you can see this very vulgar name literally just round the corner from Coffee Yard. So if you wanted to find a Georgian prostitute, Coffee Yard's probably one of the best places to start out. Now, one particular coffee house, which was down in London at Covent Garden, known as Mole King's Coffee House, was notorious for this sort of thing. Gambling, intoxication, all-night partying. It was a brothel in all that name. A brothel with the word coffee house on the front door, basically. It avoided classification as a brothel by not supplying beds, basically.
I think it's worth mentioning that our coffee house also will not be a den of iniquity. I think that they will have an assortment of cakes, and that's about it.
There are even directory books for prostitutes in the local area that survive from the period. I've seen an example of one called Harris's List of Covent Garden Ladies or A Man of Pleasure's Calendar.
Oh my God.
So it has the most genteel Georgian name you can imagine. But it's a pretty gross. It's a catalogue of women.
Oh, no.
Sip a cup of coffee and pick your favourites.
Yeah.
There's a great quote as well from a book called A Foreign View of England in the Reigns of George I and George II, published in 1729. And this person comments, "Some coffee houses are a resort for learned scholars and for wits. Others are the resort of dandies or of politicians or again professional newsmongers. But many others are temples of Venus." You can easily recognise the latter because they frequently have as a sign a woman's arm or hand holding a coffee pot. They pass for being chocolate houses, and you are waited on by beautiful, neat, well-dressed, and amiable, but dangerous nymphs.
Oh my god. All right, so you're painting a really wonderful picture here. These coffee houses usually were kind of, you know, these havens for men. However, aside from the women of the night who would have been working in them, it doesn't sound like there were very many women hanging around in coffee houses.
Yeah, it's a very, very kind of masculine sphere. We don't really come across accounts of women entering unless they're working there, basically. Some coffee houses were run by women, but they're not a place for a woman to go and enjoy a cup of tea. No respectable woman, at least, would ever be seen in a coffee house. And this is also partly due to the very strange ideas about differences between the genders in this period.
Oh, no.
I've come across some very, very strange things that Georgian men have written. It's always the men writing this. Basically, women's brains probably just couldn't cope with these complex discussions of politics and philosophy. There was a bizarre book I came across, which was basically a scientific text about coffee, the history of the plant, the biology of the plant. And the author then pauses in the introduction to go, to any women reading this book, I'm really sorry, it's going to be full of big words.
Oh no.
But don't worry, you could ask a gentleman to define these terms for you, and maybe, you know, sparks might fly, wedding bells might ring. So there's a lot of misogyny, basically, in this period. Women shouldn't be going to these coffee houses as far as anybody is concerned, which is probably why women enthusiastically adopted tea. Coffee is loud, robust, bitter, surrounded by prostitutes and cigarette smoke. But tea is delicate, it's soothing, it's calm. You can enjoy it at home in your living room. Personally, I think I probably prefer that.
It sounds a little bit better, doesn't it?
Yeah. It sounds much more civilized than some of these supposedly civilized coffee houses of the Enlightenment. But once again, ours is going to be lovely. Do come to our coffee house.
Come to our coffee house full of cake and, you know, lattes. Yeah.
Women are welcome as well in our coffee house. Just to stress that, Sue.
I mean, so regardless of whether people drank coffee or tea or chocolate, you know, it seems like all these drinks were really popular.
Yeah, they became universal throughout society by the late 18th century, and they're written about all the time. I actually came across a quite interesting poem published in 1712, a poem in praise of tea, which I quite liked. The most quintessentially English thing you could possibly imagine.
I'm really surprised they didn't ask me to memorize this for my citizenship test.
Well, it's a very, very long poem, I have to say. If you did memorize it, well done. The poem, basically, it has the classical gods of the ancient world. So it's a very strange setting for tea. It's on Mount Olympus. And they're at a banquet. Now, the god Bacchus, also known as Dionysus, who is this god of, you know, wine, intoxication, and religious ecstasy, things like that, he is serving wine and shouting about the virtues of alcohol. Whilst I believe it's Hebe, the goddess of eternal youth, she is arguing against Bacchus in favour of tea as the superior drink to alcohol. So I will not read you the entire poem, because we'll be sat here for like a half hour or something. I picked out just a few of my favourite stanzas from it. So we'll read this out between us. This would have rhymed a bit better, I think, in the 18th century dialect, but mostly it still works pretty well today. So we start with, tea, heaven's delight, and nature's truest wealth, that pleasing physic and sure pledge of health, the statesman's counsellor, the virgin's love, the muse's nectar, and the drink of love.
There, chemists, there your grand elixir see. The panacea you should boast is tea. There, sons of art, your wishes double the find. Tea cures at once the body and the mind.
You know 'tis tea whose power new strength allows, and drives the slumber from your yielding brows. Nights conquered and weary stars retire, yet still the mind preserves her active fire. What greater good than tea can mortals reap? It lengthens life, while thus it shortens sleep.
Immortals hear, said Jove, and cease to jar. Tea must succeed to wine as peace to war. Nor by the grape let man be set at odds, but share in tea the nectar of the gods.
The most British poem ever. If you liked this episode, you should go visit our new coffee shop at Barley Hall in Coffee Yard, on the Snickle Way between Swinegate and Stonegate, open in July 23rd, where you can enjoy drinks and light snacks. Each of the tables in the coffee shop will feature artifacts from our collection, relating to historic coffee culture, and anyone wanting to find out more can access fun videos via their mobile phone to delve deeper into this fascinating part of York's Georgian coffeehouse scene. It's also the same weekend as our new exhibition, The Bard at Barley, opens, which you can purchase tickets for at barleyhall.co.uk.
Don't forget to rate and review that Your Big Viking Thing podcast on your podcast app. And if you enjoyed the show, share us with a friend. It's the best way to help support your favorite history podcast. To contact us for more information or suggest ideas for future episodes, you can email us on podcast@yorkat.co.uk. Thanks for listening to that Jorvik Viking Thing podcast. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Transcripts and chapter markers are available on jorvikthing.buzzsprout.com. That Jorvik Viking Thing podcast is a production of the Jorvik Group and York Archaeology. Hosted by Miranda Schmiederer and Lucas Norton. Researched by Lucas Norton, Ashley Fisher, and Miranda Schmiederer. Produced by Ashley Fisher, sound designed and edited by Miranda Schmiederer.